From Washington, CBS Radio is bringing you the annual State of the Union message by the President of the United States. This is Charles Collingwood speaking to you from the floor of the House of Representatives in the United States Capitol. The floor and the galleries are full. The 530 members of both houses of Congress are already in their seats. The Senate entered a few minutes ago. Also in the President's audience here in the House chamber are the members of the Supreme Court, the Diplomatic Corps, the Cabinet, and an especially distinguished visitor, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, the Right Honorable Winston Churchill, who is sitting in the President's own gallery with Mrs. Truman. In just a moment, the arrival of the President will be announced by Mr. W.M. Miller, the doorkeeper of the House. Mr. Churchill prolonged applause when he entered, and now the great doors open on the center aisle. The doorkeeper of the House, W.M. Miller.
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
Everyone stands and applauds as President Truman, flanked by the committee from each House of Congress who were delegated to escort him, walks down the center aisle. In the presiding officer's chair is Vice President Barkley and Speaker of the House, Rayburn. President Truman is shaking hands now with Vice President Barkley, Speaker Rayburn, broad smiles on their faces. He turns now, puts down his speech, acknowledges the applause with nods. He's wearing a plain blue suit and tie, smiling. He opens his speech and waits for the applause to die down. Speaker Rayburn is about to rap his gavel.
Members of the Congress, I have the high privilege and the great pleasure of presenting to you the President of the United States.
Feel as good as you look? Feel as good as you look?
Members of the Congress, I have the honor to report to the Congress on the State of the Union. At the outset, I should like to speak of the necessity for putting first things first as we work together this year for the good of our country. The United States and the whole free world are passing through a period of grave danger. Every action you take here in Congress and every action that I take as president must be measured against the test of whether it helps to meet that danger. This will be a presidential election year, the year in which politics plays a large part in our lives, a larger part than usual. That's perfectly proper. But we have a great responsibility to conduct our political fights in a manner that does not harm the national interest. We can find plenty of things to differ about without destroying our free institutions and without abandoning our bipartisan foreign policy for peace. When everything is said and done, all of us, Republicans and Democrats alike, all of us are Americans, and we're all going to sink or swim together. We're moving through a perilous time, faced with a terrible threat of aggression. Our nation has embarked upon a great effort to help establish the kind of world in which peace shall be secure. Peace is our goal. Not peace at any price, but a peace based on freedom and justice. We're now in the midst of our effort to reach that goal. On the whole, we've been doing very well. Last year, 1951, was a year in which we met and threw back aggression, added greatly to our military strength, and improved the chances for peace and freedom in many parts of the world. This year, 1952, is a critical year in the defense effort of the whole free world. If we falter, we can lose all the gains we've made. If we drive ahead with courage and vigor and determination, we can, by the end of 1952, be in a position of much greater security. The way will be dangerous for the years ahead, but if we put forth our best efforts this year and next year, we can be over the hump in our effort to build strong defenses. When you look at the record of the past year, 1951, we find important things on both the credit and the debit side of the ledger. We've made great advances. At the same time, we've run into new problems which must be overcome. Now let us look at the credit side first. Peace depends upon the free nations sticking together and making a combined effort to check aggression and prevent war. In this respect, 1951 was a year of great achievement. In Korea, the forces of the United Nations turned back the Chinese communist invasion and did it without widening the area of conflict. The action of the United Nations in Korea has been a powerful deterrent to a Third World War. However, the situation in Korea remains very hazardous. The outcome of the armistice negotiation still remains uncertain. In Indochina and Malaya, our aid has helped our allies to hold back the communist advance, although there are signs of further trouble in that area. In 1951, we strengthened the chances of peace in the Pacific region by the treaties with Japan and the defense arrangements with Australia, New Zealand, and the Philippines. In Europe, combined defense has become a reality. The free nations have created a real fighting force. This force is not yet as strong as it needs to be, but it is already a real obstacle to any attempt by hostile forces to sweep across Europe to the Atlantic. In 1951, we also moved to strengthen the security of Europe by the agreement to bring Greece and Turkey into the North Atlantic Treaty. The United Nations, the world's greatest hope for peace, has come through a year of trial stronger and more useful than ever. The free nations have stood together in blocking communist attempts to tear up the charter. At the present session of the United Nations in Paris, we, together with the British and the French, offered a plan to reduce and control all armaments under a foolproof inspection system. This is a concrete, practical proposal for disarmament. But what happened? Vyshinsky laughed at it. Listen to what he said. "I could hardly sleep at all last night. I could not sleep because I kept laughing. The world will be a long time forgetting the spectacle of that fellow laughing at disarmament." Disarmament is not a joke. Vyshinsky's laughter met with shock and anger from the people all, and as a result, Mr. Stalin's representative received orders to stop laughing and start talking. If the Soviet leaders were to accept this proposal, it would lighten the burden of armaments and permit the resources of the earth to be devoted to the good of mankind. But until the Soviet Union accepts a sound disarmament proposal and joins in peaceful settlements, we have no choice except to build up our defenses. During this past year, we have added more than 1 million men and women to our armed forces. The total is now nearly 3.5 million. We have made rapid progress in the field of atomic weapons. We have turned out $16 billion worth of military supplies and equipment, three times as much as the year before. Economic conditions in the country are good. There are 61 million people on the job. Wages, farm incomes, and business profits are at high levels. Total production of goods and services in our country has increased 8% over last year, about twice the normal rate of growth. Perhaps the most amazing thing about our economic progress is the way we are increasing our basic capacity to produce. For example, we are now in the second year of a 3-year program which will double our output of aluminum, increase our electric power supply by 40%, and increase our steelmaking capacity by 15%. We can then produce 120 million tons of steel a year, as much as all the rest of the world put together. This expansion will mean more jobs and higher standards of living for all of us in the years ahead. At the present time, it means greater strength for us and for the rest of the free world in the fight for peace. Now, I must turn to the debit side of the ledger for the past year. The outstanding fact to note on the debit side of the ledger is that the Soviet Union in 1951 continued to expand its military production and increase its already excessive military power. It is true that the Soviets have run into increasing difficulties. Their hostile policies have awakened stern resistance among free men throughout the world. And behind the Iron Curtain, the Soviet rule of force has created growing political and economic stresses in the satellite nations. Nevertheless, the grim fact remains that the Soviet Union is increasing its armed might. It is still producing more war planes than the free nations. It has set off two more atomic explosions. The world still walks in the shadow of another world war. And here at home, our defense preparations are far from complete. During 1951, we did not make adequate progress in building up civil defense against atomic attack. This is a major weakness in our plans for peace, since inadequate civilian defense is an open invitation to a surprise attack. Failure to provide adequate civilian defense has the same effect as adding to the enemy's supply of atomic bombs. In the field of defense production, we have run into difficulties and delays in designing and producing the latest types of airplanes and tanks. Some machine tools and metals are still in extremely short supply. In other free countries, the defense buildup has created severe economic problems. It has increased inflation in Europe and has endangered the continued recovery of our allies. In the Middle East, political tensions and the oil controversy in Iran are keeping the region in a turmoil. In the Far East, the dark threat of communist imperialism still hangs over many nations. This, very briefly, is the good side and the bad side of the picture. Taking the good and bad together, we've made real progress this last year along the road to peace. We've increased the power and unity of the free world. And while we were doing this, we have avoided world war on the one hand and appeasement on the other. This is a hard road to follow. But the events of the last year show that it is the right road to peace. We cannot expect to complete the job overnight. The free nations may have to maintain for years the larger military forces needed to deter aggression. We must build steadily over a period of years toward political solidarity and economic progress among the free nations in all parts of the world. Our task will not be easy, but if we go at it with a will, we can look forward to steady progress. On our side are all the great resources of freedom, the ideals of religion and democracy, the aspiration of people for a better life, and the industrial and technical power of a free civilization. These advantages outweigh anything the slave world can produce. The only thing that can defeat us is our own state of mind. We can lose if we falter. The middle period of a great national effort like this is a very difficult time. The way seems long and hard. The goal seems far distant. Some people get discouraged. That's only natural. But if there are any among us who think we ought to ease up in the fight for peace, I want to remind them of three things, just three things.